Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
All my soul, you're my playground love.
Hi, my name is Chelsea Fairless.
And I'm Lauren Garoni, and welcome to the inaugural episode of the Every Outfit Book Club.
And our first book club choice is basically our version of the Bible, which is Sofia Coppola's new book, Sofia Coppola Archive. She, of course, is our queen.
Before we get into the book itself, we are basically going to discuss her life. We're just going to do from memory. No outline needed.
Well, maybe not so much her whole life, but I guess the origins of her it girldom, right?
Yes.
Or do you want to talk about The Godfather 3? Up to you.
She is the OG Nepo baby. But we didn't even refer to her as a Nepo baby. If you remember, and it's shown in this book, people just were really obsessed with calling her a dilettante. And I feel like the origin of that is her father put her in Godfather 3 in the role that Winona Ryder was supposed to play. And she was notoriously bad in the movie. I just want to say she's not the biggest problem in Godfather 3. I would say the biggest problem not enough people discuss is the fact that her storyline, she's Michael Corleone's daughter, is having an affair with her own cousin, played by Andy Garcia.
See, I've never seen Godfather 3. I've just seen the clip of her getting shot or whatever.
That pretty much cured her of any interest in acting.
And thank God.
Yeah, and throughout the 90s, she just was an artistic vibe. She studied fine arts at CalArts. She had a couple of Comedy Central shows that she hosted with Zoe Cassavetes, one of which is High Octane, the other is Chow LA, which if you and I ever had a show, that would be very influential to the aesthetic of what we would do, I think.
Absolutely. She started her clothing line Milk Fed, which is how I first came to find out about her. I discovered Sofia Coppola because of this very iconic, or at the very least iconic to me, article about her that was in 17 magazine. It was in the September issue in 1997. I remember Reese Witherspoon was on the cover. And it was basically a 4-page story about her guide to Los Angeles. I didn't know anything about her, but I read that and I was like, this is the coolest person I have ever seen in my life. Like, I just became instantly obsessed with her. And from that point on, I did like everything in my power to get more information about her. But it's funny now looking at that because some of them are places we still go, like Wasteland and Book Soup and stuff. I remember very specifically that she bought a copy of Franny and Zoe.
Evidently, Book Soup had its own cafe. Very jealous that no longer exists.
She talked about going to Chinatown to buy clothes. And that was such a thing in that era. Like, there were a lot of Chinese American designers that were really popping off at that time, like Vivian Tam and Anna Sui and stuff. So it's like you would literally just go to the import store and buy like those midi skirts and like those embroidered shoes and stuff.
I also remember seeing the MTV piece of her and Spike Jonze producing a guerrilla fashion show for X-Girl after they knew that the Marc Jacobs show was letting out, so they decided to just do this guerrilla fashion show in the streets so that everyone coming out of that show would see it.
And she was also just kind of like around, like you'd see her photographed in the party pages of magazines and stuff. And like she was in the Madonna video for Deeper and Deeper. She was in the really, really iconic Chemical Brothers Electro Bank music video, which we do not talk enough about as a culture, which was directed by her then husband, Spike Jonze. And she basically just plays this ruthless gymnast.
Yeah, I mean, that's the closest she gets to acting after Godfather 3.
A lot of the actual gymnastics was a stunt double. Like, we can tell that she's doing the ribbon dancing and stuff, but she's not doing, like, 10 backflips in a row.
She's incredibly talented, but gymnastics is not one of them. She does have a very, what we would call, Nepo baby start to her directing career, because while getting her MFA at CalArts, she reads The Virgin Suicides.
Because Thurston Moore recommended it to her, which is a crucial detail. I think it's really important to talk about how well-connected she was to people that were kind of at the forefront of quote-unquote alternative culture, whether it was Thurston Moore and Kim Gordon or her husband Spike Jonze.
Or even her best friend Zoe Cassavetes.
Yeah.
She's never written a screenplay before. As a test, she decides to adapt a couple of chapters. She writes the screenplay on spec, which is unheard of for a book you don't own the rights to. Learns that someone else has the rights, goes to these producers, begs them to be able to be given the job to write the script and direct the film, having only directed a short film before. And wouldn't you know it, they give her the shot.
And thank God, because she's actually incredibly talented, which is what sets her apart from other Nepo babies. Because you can't even say, like, sure, she's a director, but her worldview is so different than her father's. Only she could make the movies that she's making. In retrospect, The Virgin Suicides is just, like, so stunning for that to be her first movie. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, I think that's how I was introduced to her. I remember renting The Virgin Suicides at Blockbuster. But I do have to say, I'm someone who is obsessed with Sofia Coppola. A lot of my aesthetics is probably learned from just whatever she liked, but I've only seen her movies once. They're not rewatchables for me. Like, I only just rewatched The Virgin Suicides.
I've watched some of them twice, but I don't think I've watched any of them more than that. Although they are so major and incredible, and I'm obsessed with her, obviously.
And yet we can quote articles written about her from the 90s.
To put this in a historical context for maybe some of our younger listeners, when I heard about Sofia Coppola, the internet wasn't a thing. So I was always obsessed with Sofia Coppola's personal taste, like what she was wearing, what books she was reading, what music she was listening to, all of that shit, before I even saw any of her movies. And that's the way I found out about a lot of shit. Her mentioning Picnic at Hanging Rock is probably why I watched it. You know, I'm sure there's many examples of that, because I was voraciously consuming anything that was written about her. I remember reading that she was adapting The Virgin Suicides. And so I then like read it before the movie came out and was like completely obsessed with the book. And I have this school notebook. I'll put a photo of it in the show notes, where I wrote The Virgin Suicides like in giant bubbly lettering above a picture of Courtney Love. There's a lot of whole lyrics on this notebook as well. And I was very clearly not doing well mentally. But anyway,
I also think that she presented a very feminine point of view that was just missing, and is kind of still missing aesthetically.
This is why we stan, and we have no choice but to stan. I just want to note that we are drinking Sofia Coppola wine right now, the iconic mini cans.
I also think about the fact that we were at a very impressionable age, adolescent, teenagerhood, when she was coming out with movies. She came out with Lost in Translation. Her dad made a sparkling canned wine of her name. She was doing collaborations with Marc Jacobs. She was in the zeitgeist in multiple ways that mattered to us.
Absolutely.
The book is made up of every time she was on set, She took photographs, but also she has boxes for each project. During the pandemic, she went through these boxes. The book is divided by each film she's done. And so there are the photos she's taken on set and also ephemera, like letters she's written, script pages, shot lists.
It's such a beautiful book. And honestly, the only problem I have with it is that this archive does not include things that don't have to do with her movies. Like Milk Fed, like her early photographs and TV shows, the Marc Jacobs ads, like all of these things. I also need to mention that I did go to the book signing for this book at the Grove recently with my friends Lizzie and Adri, and it was so bizarre to see Sofia Coppola have to like sit there taking selfies with people in front of a Barnes & Noble step and repeat. You know what I mean? Like, she's so glamorous, I can only really think about her as being, like, at the Mercer.
She's just someone you see in Nolita or Soho, sort of a block ahead.
But true to form, she was wearing a navy and cream striped boat neck shirt, a pair of jeans, and Chanel ballet flats.
I think my favorite thing in this book are the emails that she's printed out from her own Gmail account asking various people questions.
So it starts with the virgin suicides, which is, I think, the most interesting part because it's her first movie, because it's such an iconic movie, but because we get artwork from a lot of other great artists. Like, she hired Corinne Day to be the on-set photographer, which was like a truly insane choice, an inspired choice, because even though she's someone that is really associated with heroin chic, she came up by taking some of the earliest and most iconic photos of Kate Moss when she was in that sort of girl becoming a woman stage. So it's, she's kind of the perfect, like, non-creepy person to bring in and photograph all of these adolescent girls.
And she discusses how William Eggleston was a huge inspiration. I feel like that's how I learned about him.
This is exactly it. She was the gateway drug for me for so many great artists. Also, we should note that Mike Mills designed a lot of the artwork for this film, and his work during that period was just so incredible, his graphic design work. So it's like everyone she brought onto this project was really major. Getting Air to do the score maybe a year or two after their first album came out, which had an impact for sure.
And you had someone like an Eric Clapton doing music for the Lethal Weapon films, but you never had this kind of indie artist who, you're right, just released their first album a year or two before, be the composers of a film.
It's because she was tapped in.
This is especially crazy. Mike Mills made this poster for their premiere at Sundance where the band Air played.
See, I'm never not going to just have this reverence for her as the coolest person in the world. I still think she is.
But I do think it bears mentioning the fact that I can't think of another director who's had such a cultural impact whose work has been so derided.
Because it's hyper-feminine.
And also because she's the daughter of Francis Ford Coppola, and she gave a terrible performance in Godfather 3. So people didn't even want to acknowledge that this could be a good film. It was poorly reviewed, it didn't do well in the box office, but in my mind, and this is speaks to, I think, our age, like, this was such a blockbuster film for me.
For me, this was The Godfather. Also, can we talk about how gorgeous the Karen Kilimnik illustrations are in here from The Virgin Suicides? That's another person like Sofia Coppola that I feel like is one of our just girly queens that really celebrates that look. And I love her also. One thing that's really fascinating, though, in The Virgin Suicides part of this book is the correspondence with Jeffrey Eugenides, who wrote The Virgin Suicides. And she includes a letter that he sent her, I guess, before they'd even started filming.
Right. It's a very panicked letter about him sending his notes on the script, but that script getting lost in the mail, so it had to be delivered to someone else.
He seemed like he was very concerned about where this film would go. And then she also includes an email to him where she was basically like, I'm putting together this book, I want to include the letter, like, is this okay with you? And he writes back being like, God, I was such a whiny little bitch. It's like, yeah.
Yeah. Hindsight and it being a beloved cult classic now does a lot for one's perspective.
Absolutely. I also love the photo of her directing, and she's wearing like a little mini dress, and she captions it like, I very deliberately wanted to wear dresses because no one would see someone in a dress as a director, and she wanted to sort of challenge that notion of women being filmmakers and how women have to present themselves. But she was basically like, now I would never do that shit. I'd never wear open-toed shoes because equipment can fall on you and it's just not safe.
Yeah, that is what I noticed with her sandals. I was like, bad decision. When she talks about Lost in Translation, I love that she's like, yeah, I used to go to Tokyo a lot in my 20s because I would shoot campaigns for Hysteric Glamour. And it's like, oh, right, you're the coolest fucking person alive.
See, I want to see that shit. That's right. The thing. I want to see more of that shit. Because again, she surrounded herself with some of the coolest creatives of that era. When Lost in Translation came out, when she got nominated for an Oscar, I felt like personally validated by it. Because I was like, this is my girl. I've been rooting for her for years.
This was just also such an inspired red carpet run because Marc Jacobs, who was her friend forever, dressed her for the Academy Awards.
And she had been in the fragrance campaigns, I think, by that point.
Oh, God, you're right. Those were so good, too. God,
so good. It. She was in the swimming pool. Also, I didn't know that she was the first American woman to be nominated for Best Director at the Oscars, which is sad and crazy. And also the first non-criminal Italian-American to be on the cover of the New York Times magazine.
Right, because Lynn Hirschberg did a cover story about her and told her that fact.
And Lynn Hirschberg really does a Q&A with her at the beginning of this book where she talks about all of her films and her process and stuff, which is great and fascinating.
On the New York Times magazine, they call her a dilettante. She was the dilettante daughter of a Hollywood legend. Whoever thought she would become one of America's most promising directors?
So sexist.
I don't think I realized at the time that this film came out that this was her meditation on her own divorce from Spike Jonze.
We know that the Giovanni Ribisi character is Spike Jonze and that the Anna Faris character is Cameron Diaz because they had just worked together on Being John Malkovich. So I was really shocked when I saw the wardrobe references for that character in this book, and Cameron was included.
So Sofia Coppola wins an Oscar for this, for screenplay, which, previous to Kathryn Bigelow winning Best Director, was the only award they would give to female writer-directors. Was like, we're not going to give you Best Director, but we will give you Best Screenplay.
Well, they're still doing that. I mean, that's Sarah Pauly at last year's Oscars.
To go back to Sofia Coppola being the coolest fucking person ever alive, she's included for Lost in Translation. Her script notes, which she wrote on a notepad from the Mercer.
But that's genius because it's like she's giving us what we want. She is that bitch. I want to know what it's like to have her life. She's someone that's had a proximity to fame for her whole life, even before she was famous herself. And you can really sort of see that in Lost in Translation in Somewhere, certainly.
Early on, the story about her was she also interned for Chanel at 15.
And we need to talk about the fact that she also did the costume design for her father's portion of New York Stories. Have you ever seen that movie?
Oh, yeah, of course. The anthology series.
Where she dressed little girls in Chanel. That's another thing I would like to see in this book.
Oh, there's definitely going to be a volume 2 and 3 coming at some point in her life.
Even though in The Virgin Suicides, we got the incredible Air score. Most of the songs were from the 60s and 70s. Whereas in Lost in Translation, we're getting songs by Roxy Music. We're getting songs by the Jesus and Mary Chain. And these kinds of artists would continue to appear in her films in the future.
Yeah, no one has done more for shoegaze than Sofia Coppola. Before we get into her next film, Marie Antoinette, I do feel like we need to get into a little bit of an aside, which is for the December 2004, January 2005 issue of Paris Vogue.
Oh my God.
She was the guest editor. And this was a time, because I was so obsessed with fashion, my parents subscribed to French Vogue for me as a Christmas present. And I have the issue, which I'm showing Chelsea right now, which I'm glad I held on to this because if shit ever goes bad, these are going for like $300 on eBay.
I know. I actually have 2 copies of it. I don't know why. This was one of the best magazines I've ever bought in my life.
This is when magazines were magazines, baby. So she's doing the creative direction on editorials, but she's also giving us something that I think you're speaking to missing from this book, which is just candid photos from her life.
She's really telling you what her tastes are, what her medicine cabinet looks like, what her favorite movies are, who her favorite style icons are.
The book begins with a photo of her very messy office from her house in LA. But at this point, she had moved to New York. So during the awards run for Lost in Translation, I remember this so much. She took up residence at the Chateau Marmont, and there's a great photo of her Manolo Blahniks and Chanel shoes just lining the hallway of her suite.
Well, there's also a photo of this insane Louis Vuitton. Is it a DVD player or a CD player?
A CD player, yes.
It's like, imagine a huge elaborate trunk. Inside it is also all of these DVDs. I forget what DVD she had. Can you find that page?
Oh, look, there's a Sex and the City six seasons DVD for French audiences.
That's great. This really situates this in a place and time. What movies does she have?
No. It is a CD player, but below that, she's got Lolita, All That Jazz, Rumblefish, Gilda, The Thin Man, Al Pacino, Scarface.
I started watching Bob Fosse movies because of Sofia Coppola and because of this issue in particular, because she has All That Jazz there. And then there's photos of Quentin Tarantino's house because they were dating at the time. And you see his, like, Star 80 poster, which is like Polish or something.
Yeah, this Star 80 poster basically looks like a blow-up sex doll with an open mouth.
It's so incredible. I aspire to own that one day.
Sofia Coppola has talked about that brief moment where she dated Quentin Tarantino as a very bizarre time, which she's almost erased from any amount of pop culture other than this document.
It makes me like both of them more. I've always respected the fact that Quentin Tarantino has dated a kind of varied group of women, when you think about it, between Mira Sorvino, Margaret Cho, Sofia Coppola, and obviously he has strong female protagonists in his movies. But for Sofia Coppola, it let me learn something about her, which is that she might have more of a sense of humor than we think she does, because she is many things. She is all the things. But she's not someone that I think of as being funny, per se. Although there's wonderful humor in a lot of her movies.
You see that more in Chow LA. It's a very deadpan humor that I think very much aligns with, like, a Nathan Fielder. The other thing I got from this book, and as I'm flipping through this French Vogue that I really did not know about her, she's really into Muhammad Ali.
She fucking loves Muhammad Ali. And there's this photo of Muhammad Ali in the Paris Vogue. So this is one of those Sofia Coppola obsessions that I've been conscious of for a hot minute.
She talks about Muhammad Ali in this book in reference to the Cannes Film Festival. She says, I was terrified. My friend told me that when Muhammad Ali was going in the ring, he would ask himself, did I train hard enough? Did I do everything I can? I asked myself that and knew I had done my best.
Beyond how great her movies are, the casting of all of her movies is really spectacular when you look at it, when you look at all of these films together.
Sofia Coppola was the first filmmaker that made me realize that casting, costume, production design, music are choices.
For sure.
And also you can make incongruous choices as an artistic statement.
For sure. Marie Antoinette being the prime example of that.
So there is something called a blank check in Hollywood. It doesn't really exist anymore because all we do is make movies that cost no money or all of the money. But there used to be this idea that if you win an Academy Award, if your movie makes a bunch of money, you can make any project you want. And Marie Antoinette is very much Sofia Coppola's blank check film.
I need to revisit that movie because that's one Sofia Coppola film that I've only seen once. And I don't know why. I remember liking it at the time, but not being obsessed with it. Like, I recognize the soundtrack is incredible. This is the best looking movie I've ever seen in my life. You know what? I'm just going to be real. I was pissed that I didn't get to see Kirsten Dunst get her head chopped off, you know? I had the same reaction to the Daniel Day-Lewis Lincoln movie.
Holy shit.
I was like, I've been in this movie for the whole time. Like, but I don't think Sofia Coppola is that interested in violence, just generally.
No, and we will get into that when we discuss The Beguiled.
Also, I will concede that the way she ended Marie Antoinette was major, just showing the destroyed bedroom was haunting.
I do remember being in Parsons at this time, and I would say that the hatred for Sofia Coppola was at an all-time high, because I remember a teacher I had saying, who better to make a film about Marie Antoinette, a spoiled brat, than another spoiled brat?
Fire that bitch.
people really did not want to like Sofia Coppola in a way that we've only held that same hatred for like Anne Hathaway and Jennifer Lawrence.
She's scandal-free.
Something that this book made me realize is I used to collage way more, and everything has become so digital that like I too want to make lookbooks for movies just from like
tear sheets.
Yeah, tear sheets or printing out photos.
Yeah, and you see her tear sheets for Marie Antoinette, a lot of which are from Galliano during that era.
I also don't think there has been a filmmaker who has pulled fashion references we love and put them into films since maybe Eyes of Laura Mars. There's a spread in her book about this very famous Guy Burdon photograph where it's the handmaiden sort of servant girl putting on a woman's shoes that she then took and put in that famous Marie Antoinette scene.
Also the fact that she was so inspired by New Romantics fashion, new wave music from that period, it just all came together so perfectly. Also, regarding the costumes, we should note that she hired Milena Cannonero, who's one of the most brilliant costume designers ever, who did the costumes for Barry Lyndon, which was most certainly an influence on this particular film. And also your favorite movie, Dick Tracy.
Yeah, baby. She was also given unprecedented access to Versailles. Like, Priscilla was not shot in Graceland. They had to recreate.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was shot in Toronto.
Well, I kind of get that because having visited Graceland, everything looks old now. Like, it looks like it's kind of been abandoned for years. Not that it's dusty, but you can sort of see the age in the carpets and stuff like that. Like, I feel like you'd have to recreate it just so it looks new.
I'm sure it's on the Marie Antoinette DVD. Her mother documented the whole process of making Marie Antoinette, which I have to imagine is a documentary probably on the DVD. But her mother is an amazing documentarian in her own right. She did a movie that came out in the early 90s about the making of Apocalypse Now called Heart of Darkness. It's one of the best making of documentaries of a film ever.
Okay, so to your Parsons teacher's point, I loved the detail where she said that she showed Marie Antoinette to John Curran and Rachel Feinstein, and they were like, oh, so you basically did a self-portrait as Marie Antoinette.
Wow. I love this photo of Anna Sui and Linda Ramone in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, just in their normal clothing.
Okay, so this is like a perfect example of why being Sofia Coppola just isn't normal, because these are the kind of people that show up on set. There's also a photo with Pedro Almodovar and Wes Anderson. And of course, Bridget Lacombe stopped by to take some set photos.
The movie was not well received, did not do well at the box office. I think she was pretty wounded from making that movie. She also met her partner, now husband, Thomas Mars from the band Phoenix, who she was dating at the time of making Marie Antoinette.
And they were in Marie Antoinette.
She put a Phoenix song in, which now she says she puts a Phoenix song in everything for good luck. They had a baby. She moved to Paris. She took some time off.
She came back with Somewhere, which is the only Sofia Coppola movie that I had never seen until last night when I watched it. It is so major. I enjoyed watching it so much. It's like After Sun for the 1%.
I was going to say, I remember at the time saying that it was a very special episode of Entourage, is what it feels like. I remember her talking about making the movie, that she was living in Paris, missing America, missing Los Angeles, and just buying Us Weekly at the Parisian newsstand. And she would rip stuff out and put it up against her wall. And that kind of started the inspiration for Somewhere.
And in this book, she basically says that Stephen Dorff's character was inspired by Heath Ledger, Robert Pattinson, those types of guys. The idea that it's like what happens to them once they get a little older, they have a young child that they're not doing a good job of taking care of necessarily. I feel like when Stephen Dorff got his script for that movie, it must have been a single page. Like, there is so little actual dialogue in this film, but I think it's genius because it really captures how mundane being a celebrity can be and how small your world gets. He's almost just like dragging himself through life and sort of letting things happen to him.
Sofia Coppola is so brilliant at her casting because, as she says, Stephen Dorff was just someone she knew throughout the years in the 90s. And she was like, he'd probably be good for this. Because I think previous to this, He was doing those, remember the first electric cigarettes?
Oh, the blue ones. Yeah, I smoked those for a bit when I quit regular cigarettes. That was a pioneering e-cigarette brand.
And a pioneering commercial that I believe is just him in Malibu, probably at his own house, in black and white. His tagline was, come on, we're all adults now.
Okay, we should drop that into this episode.
And how about not having to go outside every 10 minutes when you're in a bar with your friends? The point is, you can smoke blue virtually anywhere. We're all adults here. It's time we take our freedom back. Come on, guys. Rise from the ashes.
There's a scene in somewhere where a guy that works at the Chateau Marmont comes up to him and Elle Fanning and is like, do you want to hear a song? And he sings Teddy Bear by Elvis. So Elvis is also a through line throughout her work. Also, I was beyond fucking shocked to see the Helmut Newton references in this film and the fact that she literally recreated the car crash that killed him outside the Chateau Marmont. Like, it wasn't the exact same car that he had, but it was the same place and it was the same color.
For those who don't know, Helmut Newton used to spring, summer at the Chateau Marmont. He had a heart attack, I believe in 2004, coming out of the Chateau Marmont, had a heart attack, crashed into the barricade.
So you see Stephen Dorff kind of drive by this and the aftermath of it and be like, what happened? I think that was genius because it's kind of like the idea that all of this shit is happening around him that he's just kind of naive to because he's in this lonely world. But also you see fashion shoots happening within the hotel that are very Helmut Newton-esque. So it's basically like he was there shooting for whatever and then just died.
The timeline does connect, right? If Lost in Translation came out in 2003, 2004 would have been the award season run. So she was probably living at the Chateau Marmont when he died.
I was completely floored at the way that she captured the experience of driving through Sunset Plaza. This is my life, because for those of you who don't live in Los Angeles, Sunset Plaza, very close to the Chateau Marmont on the Strip. It's a part of Sunset that you cannot drive fast through Sunset Plaza. You're always at a crawling pace for whatever reason. And that's how she shows driving through Sunset Plaza in this film. Also, the haunting Julian Casablancas song in the swimming pool scene. I cried at the end of this movie. Like, when the helicopter was coming to pick him up and Elle Fanning was going to camp and he said, I'm sorry, I haven't been around, and she can't hear it because of the helicopter, I just burst into tears. It's just, I love this movie so much. I'm glad I finally saw it. And I'm glad that I didn't see it when it came out, because now I get to enjoy it.
Speaking of Sofia Coppola films that we've embarrassingly not seen, I had never seen The Bling Ring until yesterday.
Which is so crazy. Like, that's way crazier than me not seeing Somewhere, especially given your fetish for Los Angeles real estate. Like, you probably knew where all of these houses were to begin with.
Yeah, pretty much. What's great about this portion of the book is she has scanned her annotated Vanity Fair article.
Highlighted in pink, of course.
Of course, the famous Nancy Jo Sales, The Suspects Wore Louboutins, which she claims, because she had been living in Paris, she had recently moved back in 2010 back to New York. She didn't know about this story until she read about it in Vanity Fair. If this article came out now, someone would have licensed the article before it even came out.
Oh, for sure.
This is such a document of 2014, of like early 2010s fashion, which at the time didn't seem worth documenting, but now is such a specific moment in time.
And I love how she says in this book that the Bling Ring was a departure for her because it had a very deliberately ugly aesthetic. She says, like, that entire look was so ugly. I hated shooting in these disgusting nightclubs, but they kind of leaned into that super ugly early 2000s aesthetic, even with the clapperboard for this film, which had, as you see in this book, it has the Louis Vuitton monogram on it. Oh my God.
I'm also pointing out to Chelsea that we just connected that her own Louis Vuitton CD player that we discussed featured in the Paris Vogue from 2005.
Is in that, oh my God.
Is in Emma Watson's bedroom.
I can't.
Yeah, I mean, she shoots on digital for the first time. She does talk about how ugly it is, but it's still a Sofia Coppola film. She arts it up, right, with the layers of images of celebrities as mood boards on the various characters' walls.
Yeah, no one has ever been better at recreating a teenage girl's bedroom.
I will say, I think Leslie Mann gives maybe the most inspired performance of the film. She does not look like the mom at all, but yet she's somehow the mom.
I think the really special part about this part of the book is that so much of it is devoted to just pictures of Paris Hilton's house. Like, imagine if William Eggleston was just taking pictures in Paris Hilton's house. This is what it looks like. So you see her possessions, you see this photo of Nancy Reagan holding her as a baby, which is like, girl, don't display that. Also, like, a photo of her and Michael Jackson.
You know the connection between Paris Hilton and Michael Jackson. Kathy Hilton went to school with Michael Jackson. They were very close friends. They vowed to each name their first child Paris, which they did.
Wait, what?
Yes.
Oh my God, you just blew my mind. That's crazy.
So we should say that Paris Hilton is featured prominently in The Bling Ring because she was a victim of The Bling Ring, probably the most prolific victim of The Bling Ring, but she also let Sofia Coppola shoot in her house.
Imagine Sofia Coppola is like, I want to shoot in your house. Like, who says no to that?
About the worst thing that's ever happened to you? Yeah. Again, my favorite anecdote about The Bling Ring is that it took them robbing Paris Hilton 8 times for her to notice that shit was missing.
Moving on to The Beguiled, I feel like that was a significant period of time between The Bling Ring and The Beguiled, or was that just me?
In between this time period, she was working with Universal to adapt a true version of Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Mermaid story. It was deemed too dark by the studio and it was canceled.
But that's another example about how a big theme through most of her films is adolescent girls coming of age and in potentially dark and fucked up situations, as is the case with Priscilla Presley, Marie Antoinette. Obviously, the girls from The Virgin Suicides are fucking crazy.
And the young women featured in The Beguiled, which was a pulp novel from the 60s that became a Clint Eastwood film in the 70s, which her longtime production designer, Ann Ross, jokingly was like, you should do a remake of this. She was like, oh yeah, I could fuck this up. Because the 1970s film is all from Clint Eastwood's perspective, she realized, oh, I could definitely do a female point of view version.
The house that this was filmed in is a very famous estate, former sugarcane plantation in New Orleans that she rented from Jennifer Coolidge.
That's right.
So does Jennifer Coolidge still live in this plantation house?
No, I believe she moved to the Garden District.
That's just like so crazy to me that like all these celebrities are getting dragged for having weddings at plantations. Not that that's cool. That's fucked up, obviously. But it's so White Lotus that Jennifer Coolidge was literally living in a plantation for an extended period of time. Also, presumably when the Beyoncé Lemonade film was filmed, which was also filmed at this same location. You can see it most clearly in the music video for Sorry with Beyoncé and Serena. It is the house from Beguiled. It is Jennifer Coolidge's former residence.
That house had quite the life in 2016.
But I haven't really thought about that movie since I saw it.
This is where I depart from Sofia Coppola and my own aesthetics. Spoilers for The Beguiled. He falls down the stairs, so they have to cut his leg off, and then he gets really mad at all of them because he thinks they did it on purpose, but it's literally the 1860s, and that's the only thing you could do.
So it's like Yellow Jackets if the coach was not so chill.
I wanted them to cut off his leg out of spite.
He wasn't adding anything into the equation. He was just making everyone super horny and demented. Love Nicole Kidman, obviously, love our queen, but I was kind of surprised that Sofia cast her just because, like, I'm sorry, she doesn't look like she could be living during the Civil War. You should have actors that look like they're from the period.
That's what we have Michael Shannon for. Kristen Dunst, as she's getting older, is giving period face. Elle Fanning, great period face.
Such good period face.
I think what makes this book so special is the ephemera that she includes. For this, she includes a letter from Elle Fanning's own stationery, thanking her for having the best experience on set.
So moving on to her final film, Priscilla, which we haven't seen yet.
On the Rocks.
Oh, fuck. Was On the Rocks in this book?
Yes. See, this is how I was going to introduce.
I literally have not one, like, note from On the Rocks.
I was going to introduce On the Rocks as maybe the hooiest entry in her filmography, which was the Apple TV movie On the Rocks, where Bill Murray is a version of her dad, and Rashida Jones is a version of herself, and they gallivant around New York.
He's also a version of my father-in-law, which was truly wild to see.
Well, yes. I mean, she wrote this movie as a love letter to a type of man that was going out of style.
A kind of man that is rapidly being canceled.
Well, that was her classy way of basically saying that, but she tells a story about someone asking her father in Tokyo for a photograph, and he said, sure, come sit on my lap.
And they don't get why that's fucked up. But I think the thing that really reminded me of Tat's dad in this movie was the fact that everywhere he goes, he's on a first name basis with every single goddamn person.
Yeah, I think it's a love letter to the vaguely sexually harassing dad who would, like, never actually do anything.
Former Playboy vibes.
What I love that she does as well is she attaches photos from different movies or photographs physically into her scripts to remind her of the kind of feeling that she wants from a scene.
It is kind of genius that she cast Rashida Jones basically as herself. She's dressed as Sofia Coppola.
Yeah, and it's a writer character who feels conflicted between her creative life and having a family.
And Bill Murray actually always reminds me of my dad. That's who I would cast to play my dad. Who would you cast to play your dad?
Bruce Willis, but he's not really acting anymore.
We can include those people. I would cast Bill Murray as my dad and Diane Keaton as my mom.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, Bruce Willis just because of the physical resemblance, but I don't know, maybe like Jack Nicholson.
As your dad?
Yeah. And Talia Shear as my mom.
Wait, I don't even know who that is.
What are you talking about? It's Sofia Coppola's aunt. It's Michael Corleone's sister. It's Robert Schwartz's mom.
Now I know. I also might cast Mary Steenburgen as your mom.
Ooh, that's good. Yeah.
Like, that I can totally see. Shall we talk about Priscilla?
Yeah, now we can talk about Priscilla, Chelsea.
That was truly like the lost film. Well, also, we should note that came out during the pandemic. And that came out on Apple TV Plus. They just create content and no one sees it.
I do say Apple TV is where media goes to die.
It's almost like they're shadow banned, like from the get-go or something.
However, asterisk to that, if Apple TV ever buys any of my projects, I never meant that.
Of course not.
With Priscilla, Sofia Coppola goes back to her just like meant to be production company, which is A24.
Priscilla is the combination of so many themes from her former film. So we have like it's set during the time period of the Virgin Suicides. It's also about a 14-year-old child bride like Marie Antoinette, who was married at 14 as well.
Well, she met Elvis at 14. He had the presence of mind to marry her when she was legal. But yes, right. She was living with him while underage, and there's a pretty sinister photo of the actress that plays Priscilla with Elvis and his buds at Graceland with her graduation diploma. Not that she said it, but I'm gonna guess this is her Lolita. Sofia Coppola, not really a Machiavellian type of person, but it does seem strange, especially when this movie was announced, that she was doing a movie about Elvis, yes, through Priscilla's POV, but a year after Austin Butler's Elvis film. We now understand why. We also understand why the estate of Elvis came out against this film, because it's going to probably not show Elvis in the best light. There's always a meta-ness with Sofia Coppola's films, and what I love is they recreate that famous photo of Elvis in purple, and I think Priscilla in purple, but Jacob Elordi, when he was dating Kaia Gerber, they dressed as Elvis and Priscilla for Halloween and recreated that photo. And then they broke up and Kaia Gerber is dating Austin Butler, who played Elvis. And now Jacob Elordi, her ex, is also playing Elvis.
It's so crazy.
I'm going to say that this is going to be our new favorite film. I mean, May, December, of course. Then Priscilla.
November is really going to be our month.
I think the best photo from this is Sofia Coppola dressed classically as Sofia Coppola and then the actress that plays Priscilla. And this is a flash photo that so looks of the period, it feels like Sofia Coppola is a time traveler.
Yeah, it's so true. You see a side-by-side of a photo from Priscilla and Elvis's wedding and how this wedding was recreated in the film. It is completely identical, but I, of course, love the detail that Chanel remade the dress to her exact specifications, because as we know, she's had an ongoing relationship with Chanel since she was an intern at like 15, I'm assuming.
15 indeed. And it does feel like her daughter is following in her footsteps. About a year ago, her daughter went viral when she posted on TikTok a story about how her parents don't take care of her and how a helicopter dropped her off. And a lot of people were very uncharitable, but did not understand that she was fucking joking.
I love her. I can't wait to see more of her. I hope to follow Coppolas for generations to come.
This is the Nepo family we can get behind.
I get behind Roman. He's definitely existed in Sophia's shadow, but he's done some really major shit. Like, he's co-written a lot of the Wes Anderson films. He's produced a lot of Sofia Coppola's films. I feel like we might need to watch CQ.
He also runs a pretty major music video production house. I want more movies from Gia Coppola. We need to do a whole day. We got to watch the Coppola family films.
Well, also, I noticed that Gia was an extra in Somewhere in one of the party scenes, which was fun. And Gia also has her own, of course, wine label, because Francis Ford Coppola has his own vineyard. So all of their children get their own wine. This is maybe the funniest Nepo baby thing ever. But Gia Coppola, being the youngest one, of course, decided to make natural wines. And the labels are just her photographs, which are similarly like William Eggleston vibes.
Have you had it?
I've had it. The orange wine is decent. That's like the one wine that they stock at Almore. Shout out to the only liquor store on the Sunset Strip that has natural wine.
Next to a Zanku chicken. That's a fun night, guys.
If you're just going home, you need some chicken and a bottle of wine, you gotta do that. Or you could go to Domain on Melrose, which is next to the Caliph Chicken, which is kind of the better version of what we're talking about, but you're not always over there. Anyway.
All right, guys. We've spent nearly an hour talking about our love of Sofia Coppola.
And honestly, I just feel so full of joy. Like, I love her so much. And I love that this is one of those things that we both, like, are obsessed with.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And having now made my first film, it's really revived my love. And it makes me just want to make tactile lookbooks and put all my friends in my movies.
Sounds amazing.
All right. Until next time, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Are you missing the sounds that matter most? What if you could hear every word, every laugh, and every moment crystal clear without spending thousands on expensive hearing aids? Introducing Audionatum, the world's most affordable FDA-approved hearing aid. With the revolutionary A2 chip, you get premium sound, zero background noise, and a 24-hour rechargeable battery. They even have Bluetooth connectivity to connect to your cell phone or TV. Unlike those traditional bulky $5,000 prescription hearing aids, the Audionatum is 90% smaller, 20 times cheaper, and works instantly. No visits to the audiologist needed. Audionatum has over 500,000 happy customers who have trusted Audionatum to restore their hearing. Our 100% money-back guarantee means zero risk to try. Don't like them? Simply return them and get your money back. They also come with a lifetime warranty. For the next 72 hours, the Audionatum is 53% off. Go to tryhearingaid.com right now to order your pair for only $99. Again, go to tryhearingaid.com to order your pair for only $99. Order now before it's too late, as these hearing aids have sold out over 10 times this year. With Audionatum, you can hear life again.